This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yisru Heeb, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Cameroon is making efforts to crack down on elephant poaching and ivory trafficking. Several recent busts have led officials to intensify surveillance at sea and in border areas.
That's Moki Edwin Kenzeka reporting from Yaoundé. Details coming up.
Also, a second flight recorder with data on the Egypt Air flight that crashed in the Mediterranean last month has been recovered. And the International AIDS Conference returns to Durban, South Africa in July.
We'll have these stories and more coming up.
Our top story this hour, police in northern Nigeria say Boko Haram militants have opened fire at a funeral in Adamawa State, killing at least 18 mourners. Authorities also say many others were injured in the attack on Kuta Village outside Matagalli and that the death toll could rise. Witnesses say the Islamist militants stormed the village on motorbikes and opened fire on the mourners, observing a wake. They say many of the victims were women and children.
Egyptian authorities say the vessel MV John Lettrich has pulled the second black box from the Mediterranean Sea, where Egypt Air Flight 80 crashed a month ago. The Paris to Cairo flight mysteriously disappeared from radar on May 19th with 65 people on board. Investigators aboard the salvage vessel have recently photographed large pieces of the Airbus resting on the seafloor at depths of 3,000 meters. The ship's deep-sea robot and grabbing arm has now recovered the two black boxes containing flight recorders from the tail wing and cockpit of the plane. The devices should contain recordings of pilot conversations, cockpit alarm, engine noise, and data from the aircraft that reveal the plane's speed, altitude, and direction just before the crash. Government investigators in Cairo hope the recorders will explain the cause of the plane's disappearance and crash.
Journalists face restrictions from entering the refugee camps on islands off the Greek coast. Limited information is available on the conditions of those who live there. The number of those who still cross the Aegean Sea is low compared to last year, but the refugee flow has not stopped. The refugees' future remains unknown, and Greek authorities have started arresting asylum seekers. Mariana Karakoulaki has more from Thessaloniki, Greece.
After the implementation of the agreement between the European Union and Turkey and the transformation of the refugee registration camps in the Greek islands into detention centers, there's limited information on the conditions of asylum seekers there. Major international organizations have ceased their operations inside the camps. Independent volunteers have limited access, and journalists are restricted from entering. Information on the conditions is limited, and it usually comes from volunteers. One such report was made on Wednesday night as volunteers reported the detention of 80 refugees and migrants, including minors. Refugees have been arrested last night and shipped handcuffed to Piraeus for still unknown detention centers. Pakistanis, Iranians, Africans. At least 90% of them had applied for asylum, said several volunteers. According to the press office of the police station in Mytilene, Lesbos, the number of those arrested was lower. 54 people were detained for public safety reasons, for being a threat to the local community and to other asylum seekers. Despite reports by several activists, the Greek authorities have denied that minors were among those detained. The majority of those arrested were taken to a migrant detention center in Korinthos, a town near Athens. According to Yorgos Kosmopoulos, Amnesty International's researcher for refugee rights, asylum seekers should not be detained.
Detention of asylum seekers should happen only in exceptional circumstances and for valid reasons. And in any case, no asylum seeker should never be returned to a country unless his or her asylum claim is examined.
The closure of the so-called Balkan route and the implementation of the EU-Turkey agreement left thousands of asylum seekers stranded in Greece, yet new arrivals are being documented at the Greek islands. According to the latest figures issued by the Greek authorities, 56,814 refugees and migrants are in the country, 8,428 of whom are in the Greek islands. 161 new arrivals have been documented as of the early morning of Friday, June 17th. With limited options available, asylum seekers in Greece wait in the dark until their asylum applications are examined. Mariana Karakulaki for Voice of America, Thessaloniki, Greece.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders has refused to accept European Union funding. That's because the EU has offered financial and political rewards to Turkey if it will prevent refugees from migrating to Europe. The International Organization Secretary General says the EU deal with Turkey seeks to stem a migration to Europe and jeopardizes the very concept of the rights of refugees. In other migration news, the U.S. Navy rescue and salvage ship stationed in Souda Bay in Greece has joined the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's effort to prevent human trafficking in the Aegean Sea between Turkey and Greece. The Associated Press reports that the U.S. vessel will perform maritime surveillance and reconnaissance. The Greek Coast Guard has rescued about 60 migrants whose sailboat had run aground on the eastern coast of the island of Lesbos. More than 30 migrants and refugees hiding in two vans were discovered by Serbian police today. The police arrested four men suspected of smuggling the migrants who were traveling the Balkan corridor to Hungary or Croatia in the European Union.
Twelve minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new report released this week during Africa Agriculture Science Week in Kigali, Rwanda, argues the African Union's Malabo Declaration underestimates the risk that climate change poses to agricultural growth and food security goals. The Montpellier panel of experts in European and African agricultural development are authors of the report. They also outlined effective ways Africa could climate-proof the declaration. Camilla Toulmin is a senior fellow at the International Institute for Environmental Development and one of the authors of the report. She spoke with me about what African nations need to do to implement climate-smart agriculture.
Some of the key concerns we have are that agricultural policy and strategy is being designed without thinking through the impacts of climate change. So we're trying to make sure that you've got a properly integrated approach between the Malabo Declaration, which African governments have signed up to, which is all about improving agricultural productivity, and thinking how that can be best supported by the climate change agreement that was signed in Paris last year.
How can African governments incorporate into the declaration?
Essentially, that's looking at sort of three big things, I guess. One is thinking about how science can best work with local farmers on building higher productivity, more sustainable, more resilient crop production systems. The second thing is how you can encourage governments to identify ways of tapping into the Green Climate Fund that has been set up following the Paris Agreement, that can be used to deliver on investment on the ground in many different parts of Africa in ways that provide for the infrastructure and the investment in particularly improving irrigation possibilities so that the increasingly variable rainfall has less of a damaging impact on the agricultural sector. And the third thing really is around making sure that markets work in favor of supporting a strong and profitable agricultural sector.
Do you see African governments working with local farmers in terms of providing them with the necessary tools that they need to be able to make their crops climate proof?
Some of that's happening. So the Ethiopian government, for instance, is doing very well in terms of both recognizing the value that local farmers bring, but also supporting a really effective system of agricultural extension and knowledge workers who can work at that very local level. Because it's all very well investing in research and technology at the national level, but actually very often the big problems are about translating that knowledge and understanding down to farm level in a way that makes sense for people operating on the ground.
The report points out that the mean temperatures across Africa are expected to rise faster than at the global average, and it could reach as high as 3 degrees Celsius to 6 degrees Celsius. So what does that really mean for Africa's farmers?
It means really quite major changes in terms of the kinds of crops that you can grow, but also the amount of rainfall that's likely to come. So some areas are going to get drier and drier, and it's going to be impossible to maintain the kinds of cropping systems that they've had so far. Hence the importance of investing in forms of irrigation that will allow crops to continue to be grown in areas that would otherwise be too dry. A lot of that temperature increase is already in the system, so it's unavoidable. Certainly in parts of North Africa and Southern Africa, people are already having to think about how they plan for a 4-degree increase, probably in the next 15 or 20 years. That's dramatic in terms of the changes to the farming system.
Do you think the African Union will incorporate this climate smart agriculture into the Malabo Declaration at a higher level?
The thing that will really make a difference is for decision makers to see the benefits of taking that approach. What we tried to do in the panel report is to identify more than a dozen examples of very clear lessons stemming from better practice in the field, whether it's around new varieties of bean, whether it's around the planting of nitrogen-fixing trees. You've got a number of really practical examples there, which we hope would inspire decision makers to recognize that they're not starting from zero. There's a lot that can be learned from experience within Africa.
That was Camilla Toulmin, a senior fellow at the International Institute for Environmental Development and one of the authors of the report. She spoke with me from London.
This past week, unarmed gunmen killed 49 people in a gay dance club in Orlando, Florida. The attacker, 29-year-old Omar Mateen, was born in New York, though his family was originally from Afghanistan. Mateen told authorities that he committed the attacks in the name of the Islamic State. Many club patrons say they had often seen him in the bar, and there are reports that he visited gay dating sites on the internet. The incident has become part of the U.S. election campaign. Donald Trump, the presumptive candidate of the Republican Party, said he is a supporter of the gay and lesbian or LGBT community. Mr. Trump also has said mosques should be put under surveillance and has repeated his support for limiting Islamic immigration to the U.S. Shahnila Mohammed is the Africa coordinator for the LGBT advocacy group Outright Action International. From Johannesburg, she talked to reporter William Eagle about the attacks. He asked her if it was unusual that Omar Mateen may have been gay, yet told others he disliked gay people.
You know, Bill, as somebody who grew up in the Muslim world myself, I think I can totally answer your question by saying that the whole issue of cultural homophobia is really quite a strong phenomenon, in the sense that if you grew up in a culture like you know I did, and like he possibly did, you know, in the Muslim world, which does not condone your very existence, you know, where homosexuality is seen as something evil, as something that needs to be eradicated, as something that should not exist, it does have an effect on how you perceive yourself. And I think that, you know, what our research and what our analysis has shown is that in these cultural homophobic societies, the biggest perpetrators of violence and abuse are the actual family members themselves. And if you look at this particular case, the gunman's father, even after the killings, was reported to have gone onto Facebook and said, well, you know, God will punish homosexuals. So, I mean, that gives you an indication of even after 49 people or 50 people, including his own son, he would still go onto Facebook and make a comment like that. So, I mean, I think that, you know, it's very possible. And we don't know the sexuality of the gunman. I mean, that's something that we can't comment on. This cultural homophobia is a huge, huge problem. And I think that's something that really needs to be taken into consideration when you look at this whole incident and how it plays itself out.
How would you rate the reaction of American politicians?
Look, you know, as outright, and we really caution against, and this is something we've been saying ever since the tragedy happened, that we really caution against giving in to attempts by politicians and by other sectors of society to create a divide between the LGBTI community and Muslims. It's important that people understand that, you know, LGBTI people who live in Muslim contexts are also going through a huge amount of violence and homophobia. And, you know, we refuse to allow the LGBTI community and this tragedy in particular to be used to pit minorities against each other, because LGBTIQ people, Muslims, LGBTIQ people all over the world need to support each other and stay strong against bigotry and violence. And I think, you know, when a tragedy like this happens, it's very easy for politicians and opportunistic people to jump on board and try to use it to push their own agendas. I mean, Donald Trump calling for the ban of Muslims into the U.S. and for monitoring of churches. I mean, for me, I think, you know, he's just jumped onto the LGBTIQ bandwagon and is trying to, in a way, corral a certain sector of society by using this tragedy. And for me, that is really disgusting. So it's really important that we don't allow this tragedy to become utilized and abused by politicians who are just trying to gain votes.
That was Shahaneela Mohammed of the LGBT advocacy group Outright Action International. She was speaking with reporter William Eagle.
Also, Australia's prime minister says he regrets inviting a Muslim cleric to an iftar dinner to celebrate the daily Ramadan fast at sunset. The dinner was held at the Australian leader's official residence, Kirribilli House. Malcolm Turnbull says he was made aware yesterday of controversial remarks previously made about homosexuals by Sheikh Shadi Al-Sulaiman. Al-Sulaiman, president of the Australian National Imams Council, said in a video uploaded to YouTube.com in 2013 that homosexual actions bring evil outcomes to our society. Turnbull says, had I known that the Sheikh had made those remarks, he would not have been invited to the iftar. An Australian newspaper contacted the Prime Minister's office about the remarks in the U.S. last Sunday. A lone Muslim American gunman launched an attack on a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, killing 49 people.
Cameroon is making efforts to crack down on elephant poaching and ivory trafficking. Several recent busts have led officials to intensify surveillance at sea and in border areas. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
This man is arguing with police at the station near the town of Kampo on Cameroon's southern border with Gabon and Equatorial Guinea. The man was arrested alongside 45 other people. He says he was just a passenger aboard the ship. But George Moncharu, Cameroon's highest wildlife official in the area, says the ship had three containers of ivory on board, weighing about 200 kilograms. The discovery was a bit of luck.
Un bateau en provenance de Libreville et qui allait au Nigeria, qui avait des problèmes.
Moncharu says the ship ran out of fuel Tuesday and had to anchor in Cameroonian waters. The vessel was traveling from Gabon to Nigeria. He says Cameroonian officials noticed the ship while it was getting fuel, and suspecting that it was owned by traffickers, they boarded it for a search. He says this is the first time Cameroon has found ivory on a sea vessel. He said the people on board were from Nigeria, Benin, Cameroon, Gambia, and Niger. A dozen have been detained for further investigation. Pang Abesolo Francois is Senior Central Africa Program Officer for the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Network Traffic. He says the tusks are believed to have been collected from elephants killed in Cameroon and Gabon.
Le revenu moyen de l'Asiatique, notamment Chine, Thaïlande et autres.
He says Asian countries are getting more appetite for luxury goods, including African ivory, as their incomes continue to rise. He says they have found out that the black market price of African ivory has increased to $3,000 per kilogram, and as such, traffickers from Central African countries are ready to take the risk. He said traffickers cut the ivory up to hide it inside art objects or carpets, and even grind it up into powder form and put it in oil drums. Africa is experiencing unprecedented slaughter of the majestic animals, and Cameroon has been no exception. By one estimate, Central Africa has lost nearly two-thirds of its elephants since 2004. Cameroon has focused its efforts on national parks, even deploying the military to track down poaching gangs. Earlier this month, seven people with tusks from 24 elephants were arrested at the Kampoman National Park, also at the country's southern border. Joseph Achaleke, Cameroon's Director of Protected Species and Endangered Wildlife, says the suspects there may be more maritime trafficking.
Sur le terrain, les mesures sécuritaires sont prises, sont un peu plus peaufinées.
He says they reinforced surveillance at sea and are working with neighboring countries to identify owners of the vessel and stop such illegal activity. But he says they rely very much on the population to inform them of suspicious activity. In April, Cameroon burned a large catch of seized ivory, including 2,000 tusks, as a show of force against poachers. The international ivory trade was banned in 1989. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Kampo.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.